Welcome to City Arts and Lectures, a season of talks and onstage conversations with some of the most celebrated writers, artists, and thinkers of our day. Alison Bechdel is the author of the graphic memoirs Fun Home and Are You My Mother? On May 7th, 2021, she talked to artist George McCallman about her latest book, The Secret to Superhuman Strength. It's a history of exercise trends, from Jack LaLanne of the 1960s to spin classes and yoga studios. It's also a very personal examination of Bechdel's own fascination with fitness. And now, a conversation with Alison Bechdel.
Hello, everyone. My name is George McCallman. It is a thrill to be here with you this evening. I am so thrilled to introduce Alison Bechdel to all of you to be in conversation this evening. Alison, how are you?
I am great, George. I'm very happy to be here chatting with you.
Yes, it's a thrill. I want to introduce everyone that both knows and doesn't know who we are, who you are, to orient the conversation. And so you have a book that just came out called The Secret to Superhuman Strength. And I would love you to describe this book to the uninitiated, just so everyone knows what we're going to be talking about.
Okay. This is a graphic memoir about, on the surface, my life in exercise, but it kind of delves into a lot of other more metaphysical than physical subjects.
So the book in and of itself, I've described this book several times to people who haven't heard of it. And the graphic novel, the graphic memoir format, still requires some explanation. And so it seems to confuse a lot of people. And if you can explain the format a little bit for someone who's picking up the book who isn't familiar with the format on the inside.
It's a comic book. It's basically a comic book, a thick one.
Yes.
It's a comic book with a lot of words. I mean, my graphic memoir slash novels are kind of on the wordy side for comics, but they're still comics. And it's just a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing to be afraid of.
Yes. So I would love to share with folks a few slides that you have to show them a little bit of what the interior, the visuals of the book looks like.
The title of the book comes from my childhood fascination with those bodybuilding and self-defense ads in my comic books, you know, with Charles Atlas in his leopard skin trunks. And after years of reading those ads in the comic book, I finally sent away for this thing, The Secret to Superhuman Strength, which I don't think I need to tell you did not impart to me the secret to superhuman strength. But I remained very fascinated with the idea of that. And over the course of my life, I have done a lot of different kinds of exercise. And I've done it for lots of reasons, not just to cultivate strength. I feel like I get all kinds of mental and emotional and psychological and even metaphysical benefits from exercise. And I'm a person who gets very stuck in my head, and, you know, physical activity really helps me to not do that so much. The book goes through my life in chronological order, so it also kind of tracks these various fitness trends that I was following, you know, kind of at the same time everyone else was doing these things. And I also talk about the way this feeling of working out very intensely, you know, like the feeling of runner's high or the heightened focus that you can get into that's a kind of a trance, is very similar to the feeling of being caught up in a creative project. And for me, that feeling came much more easily to me as a child than it does now. It's much harder to access that as an adult. So another thing I do in this book is I look at some other writers and their relationships to their creativity. I look at the British Romantics, Samuel Taylor Coleridge and William and Dorothy Wordsworth, who were always out like wandering the hills, and their experience in nature really informed the stuff they were writing. And those people really influenced the American Transcendentalists, Margaret Fuller and Ralph Waldo Emerson, both of whom had these kind of crazy ecstatic experiences in nature of feeling themselves disappear that I love. Emerson said he felt like a transparent eyeball, like his self just fell away. Margaret Fuller felt like she understood that the idea of the self was suffering, which I thought was pretty perceptive. She realized this one day when she was 21. I also write about Jack Kerouac and the hike he did with Gary Snyder when they hiked a mountain in the Sierras that he writes about in his book, The Dharma Bums. My own efforts, my sort of sporadic efforts at learning to meditate and learning about Buddhism myself, as I try to figure out, you know, try to grasp this idea that ourselves are not real, but it's very slow going. It is nothing like the psilocybin mushroom trip I had in my youth. On that day, I really got it that myself was not real, and that it was my belief in that separate self that kept me cut off from everything else in the universe. I can get little glimpses of that psilocybin feeling too in my exercise life, you know, doing things like skiing, running, just being in the woods around my house is very, very important to me. I live out in the country and I can just go out and stick my head under a waterfall when I need to. So that is the end of my slides, just to give you a sense of what the book looks like and some of the stuff I talk about.
How did you start making this book?
You know, I like that you said how is this book made? I think made is like the key word when you're talking about comics, because I really do have to grapple with the physical book in a way that I don't think people who just write with words do. Like, they just hand it off and the book designer, you know, pours all that text into the template and it goes from the left hand page to the right hand page, and it's just kind of automatic. I mean, I'm sure I'm vastly oversimplifying what book designers do, but I'm actually touching all those pages. I'm like drawing every square inch of every page, every left hand page, every right hand page, every page turn. I've got to think about what's going to be the image that you see when you turn the page. And so it's very almost sculptural engagement with the book.
And is that something that you plan ahead? Do you create a thumbnail guide to how you're doing it? Or is this just organically, you're designing it as you go along?
I wish it were more organic than it is, but I have a pretty geeky system where I actually do all my writing in Adobe Illustrator. So I'm writing, you know, I'm typing on my keyboard, but I'm arranging my text in little panels on the screen. I'm already treating the page as a two-dimensional field.
Fascinating. Amazing.
And I'm imagining what I'm going to be drawing in those panels as I write, because the story is driven as much by the images as the words, or maybe like 60-40, 60% words, 40% images. I'm not actually drawing, but I'm thinking visually as I write. It's kind of hard to explain.
So you're creating a visual outline of the book with the writing first.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I'll, you know, drag an image off the internet, or I'll do a quick sketch to figure out a scene that I'm drawing. But mostly I don't really have to draw much. Mm-hmm. It's like an outline with no pictures. It's words and no pictures.
And just to give people a sense of just, you know, a time frame. So how long would you say that it took you to write this book before you started creating the images, the illustrations for it?
This book took quite a long time. Took me 8 years from starting it to absolutely finishing it. And I wasn't super actively working the whole time. My life got very busy and kind of interrupted for a while. So I wasn't actively working all the time, but it's funny because as a memoirist, I was still living my life. So in a way, just living my life is work. So I guess I was still working. But the writing took by far the bulk of that time, you know, the research, the writing, and trying to figure out what the book was even about, because I didn't know. I never know what I'm really writing about until I'm like two-thirds of the way through something. You know, I never learned how to make an outline. Like, that just never made sense to me. How can you know what the outline is until you know what you're doing? And how can you know what you're doing until you've done it?
Right, right. I mean, it sounds to me like it is just a long form outline. You're creating the architecture of the entire thing.
I wish that were the case, and then I could like have a bigger, like a more bird's eye view, but I'm all in the tiny details of it. It's the actual book, you know. It's every sentence has to get done before I can even think about drawing it. Then I take those individual Illustrator pages and set them up in InDesign so it is like a virtual book on the screen. It's a, for people who don't know, that's a, what do you call it?
The layout page.
Yeah.
And so once you have that, what was the time frame of the making of this book, of creating the art for it?
Well, I feel sheepish about this because I wish I'd finished the writing a lot sooner and had more time for the drawing. But I did, honestly, most of the drawing in the past, like in 1 year at the end of that period. Like, yeah, just very intense, you know, long days of just drawing, which was really fun. It's my favorite thing to do.
Yeah,
is the drawing.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting that it's usually the thing that we don't have a lot of time to do? It's the thing that ends up being the crunch, which is the most, you know, rewarding part of the process.
I know. I sometimes wonder if I'm somehow punishing myself or, you know, sabotaging myself. Like, just start sooner. What is your problem?
Well, that's the existential question, Allison. If you figure this out, like, you could accomplish a lot of things.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things the book is about for me, is just the ways I get in my own way, that I have always gotten in my own way, not just creatively, but in every realm of life, almost every realm except exercise, where I feel like that's like my conflict-free zone.
Yes, exactly.
George, are you an exercise person? Do you work out?
You know, I am. I am now. I'm an outdoor exercise person. I play tennis. I ride my bike. I do yoga at home. But it is a very, I was really admiring your dedication to it, because I haven't always been that. It seems to have been a lifelong curiosity in your life. That's actually one of the questions that I had. How long have you been obsessively thinking about fitness and exercise? I was really amazed by that your continual dedication over the years.
Well, yeah, it's something I kind of stumbled on when I was 14. I found my mother's exercise book. And I had just been out sledding with my brothers in the snow. And all of a sudden, when I turned around from coming down the hill and looked back up the hill, I just felt like, oh, I'm so tired. I can't go up that hill. But, you know, all my childhood, I had this boundless energy. I would just run back up the hill. It never occurred to me to be tired. So I decided I wanted to do something about that. And I kind of never looked back. Like, I started this calisthenics program. Then I started running, and it just made me feel so good and gave me some kind of, I don't know, just space to myself that was really important to me as a kid in a kind of nutty household. It kind of saved me.
Why did you decide to make this book color when your previous one had been mostly black and white grayscale?
You know, I have a very interesting relationship to color. My father kind of terrorized me about color. He loved color. He would color in my coloring books. He'd show me how to do it better. I mean, can you imagine? Like,
that's too much pressure.
It was. So at a very early age, I like, you know, all children are so drawn to color. It's so fun picking out the crayons and the watercolors. But I lost interest in color because of my father's just like overbearing attitude. And he was always trying to encourage me to, I mean, it was great to have a parent who was encouraging my art, but you know, it can be too much as well. So in a way, I wasn't aware of this as a kid, but I do think that I kind of became a cartoonist because it was a black and white art form. And there was no, I didn't have to think about color. And this, you know, this was way back in the 80s. It was the pre-digital era. So color was quite elaborate and expensive and just not something that cartoonists generally got to do.
I read it the first time and then realized that the book was also a love letter to your mother, and that your mother had played a much larger role in the telling in your stories, and of which you yourself started realizing as your mother was dying. And so if you can talk a little bit about that process, just kind of contextualizing your relationship with your mother in the telling of this story.
Sure. You know, my mother was just such a character, a real character. She was, as a mother, kind of remote, kind of distant, and always like, you know, I just always wanted more of her, more connection. But she was an artist. You know, both my parents were artists and somehow imparted that to me without ever really sitting me down and saying, here's how you write a paragraph or here's how you draw, you know, a landscape. I just kind of absorbed it from both of them. But my mom really taught me a lot about writing. She was a very principled person. And she acted all through my life. She would do summer stock and I could see her like in her own relationship to her own creative life all the time. Like it just set this example for me. So it was weird when she started to die. You know, she got cancer in her 70s and spent like 7 years just dealing with that and slowly getting a little sicker and sicker. And actually, she died just before I began work on this book, or right about the same time I started work on the book. So in a way, the book had, I was working on it through this whole period of grief, you know, and I think that's another reason why it took so long. And it was very strange, a strange kind of grief, because my mother was like never quite there anyhow. So it was curious to miss something that wasn't there, you know. It just made it more complicated, I think.
Right. And one of the lines that you said that really struck me was, you didn't realize how much she had loomed over your life until she was dying, until she was about to leave. You know, that death can recontextualize, can radically shift all of our perspectives about our everyday lives.
I knew my mother was dying. I kept trying to brace myself for it and practice for it. I would talk to friends whose parents were dying or had died and try to like, how do people do this? But there's no way to practice until it happens. And there was no way to understand how much space she had taken up until she was gone. It's like when a tree gets taken down, you cannot imagine beforehand the void that's going to be there. There's no way to prepare for that.
So the aspect of the book that I was really, like, I went back to read it a few times, is the relationship that you have to people like Margaret Fuller and Ralph Waldo Emerson and Jack Kerouac. Tell me a little bit about why you decided to interlace these stories into your stories.
I liked the way these people, it started with Jack Kerouac, because I always loved his book, The Dharma Bones. I love this hike he went on with Gary Snyder. I just always found that kind of magical. The way they would just talk about Zen and the universe and just the way people talk together when they're moving through nature. And I knew that there was something about transcendence in this story that I was trying to get at. I didn't really know what transcendence was. I still don't. I think it's a beautiful word. I've always been interested in the transcendentalist just because what a cool name, you know, what a great thing to call yourself. So it was an excuse to then see who these transcendentalists were and what were they about. And Margaret Fuller just blew me away. Like, I only learned about her pretty recently in my life. But she is this really powerful historical figure that did not get her due. I hope that she's going to start getting more attention.
Yeah.
Because she was amazing. And she was friends with Emerson. They worked together. And
how did you decide on these figures? Like, who are they to you in adding them? And they feature pretty prominently all throughout the book.
They do. I mean, so they were all talking about the self and transcending the self in some way, which is what I wanted to learn about in this book. And then there was also the British Romantics, Wordsworth and Coleridge, and they too were hanging out in nature and having these kind of quasi-mystical experiences. So I saw this lineage, and they were also all like hippies, you know? They're all these countercultural people, like very anti-establishment, very, you know, they had very progressive politics. I don't think Emerson or Fuller were actually vegetarians, but some of those transcendentalists, they had like vegan communes, you know, in the middle of the 19th century. So
pioneers.
Yeah. So I just felt like this kind of connection back through time to this whole school of thought, these people thinking about nature. They were very influenced by Eastern philosophy. And then I got very interested in their actual lives and how they managed their lives and their work and when it was going well for them and when it wasn't and what their addictions did to them. And I just found all of their individual life stories really entrancing.
I'm curious, what is your draw to the memoir?
I just have this sort of compulsion to keep track of my own life. Probably, you know, on some primal level, it's because I felt like no one was like paying attention to me or giving me the kind of care I needed, blah, blah, blah. but how it has manifested is I'm going to take care of myself by just making sure I write down everything I do. And then I'm going to like make a book out of that and think about it. And it feels like kind of neurotic. Honestly, it feels like just a big neurotic obsessive impulse that if I were really like mentally healthy, I wouldn't have. I would just like sit here quietly in a state of bliss and I wouldn't have to make anything.
So we have a few audience questions for you. Are you competitive in sports, in work, in art?
I think I am so competitive that I can't compete. I mean, in terms of sports, like I can't bear not winning. And of course, I'm not going to win in an athletic event, so I don't even try. I've run in some races and it's awful. I don't like being passed by people. If I go out on a bike ride, I hate it when people pass me. I'll try to speed up and go as fast as I can to avoid it. I guess I am competitive. I never really thought of myself that way, but I guess I am.
One of the things that it took me like half the book to realize is that you focused on individual exercises. It's all very much the self. You know, even when you were out bike riding with your friends, it seemed like they had to kind of coax you to join them.
Yeah, I've always been just fine exercising on my own.
Can you explain what the Bechdel test is? Do you think it is still relevant today? Would you add any other criteria if you were making it up now?
Okay, the Bechdel test is this funny thing that isn't something I really declared, but somehow has been ascribed to me. But in 1985, I wrote an episode of my comic strip, Dykes to Watch Out For, where two women were trying to figure out what movie they were going to go to. And one of them said, okay, I can only see a movie if it has at least two women in it who talk to each other about something besides a man. And me and my lesbian friends in 1985 just thought that was hilarious. Like, Yeah, that's about right. There's no movies. It's crazy.
Right.
But over time, you know, just as I feel like there has been progress made, you know, the fact that this has become something that's discussed in mainstream culture is itself a sign of some, you know, shift in awareness.
Pretty incredible.
It is. Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah.
And it's funny having it attached to my name, but that's fine. I'll take it.
Do you have any advice for people struggling with parents who don't support their choice to pursue art as a career?
Wow, that is an interesting question.
That's an excellent, excellent question.
I mean, I am so fortunate. I grew up with parents who had come from working class backgrounds and were like the first generation to go to college. Well, second in my mother's case. But they weren't allowed to be artists. They had to get professional jobs, but they encouraged me to become an artist, which was amazing. So it's a very real concern. I understand how parents feel like they want their kids to like be able to make a living. And it's, you know, it's a lot less likely that you're going to make a good living as an artist than as, you know, some regular job. So I don't know what to tell people. I mean, I think if you yourself are committed enough and driven enough, you're just going to do it. You're going to find a way to do it. But it's unfortunate that you have to also struggle against your parents. I don't know what to tell you.
Can you talk about what it's like to make art while grieving?
I found it very painful. In fact, I think part of my grief process was a resistance to my work because kind of what we were just talking about, my mother didn't ever get to really be an artist. Like she had to be a high school teacher and do art on the side and she wanted to write and that didn't happen. So I feel like in a way, when she died, I got kind of stuck in my own work because I felt guilty on some level. I didn't realize this at the time. It was only later when that feeling started to shift and move that I suspected that was part of it. Like I was kind of punishing myself by not doing the thing I love. Grief is so weird.
It is intense. And I feel like we as a society don't have a lot of language for it. And I mean, American society, I should be more specific. We don't thread and leave a lot of room for grief. And so it comes, I'm really grateful to artists like yourself that show that everyday process and how it just seeps into your life if you don't address it. And it eventually can just coat everything and you're not even aware of it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a strand of the book too, is if you're not letting yourself experience grief, you're also not experiencing joy, you know? And what kind of a life is that?
That is the realest talk right there. That is absolutely the truth. And the book, once again, is The Secret to Superhuman Strength. It is a fantastic book. Allison, it was such a pleasure to chat with you. Thank you so much for your time this evening.
Thank you, George. It was a delight. Nice to meet you.
You've been listening to Allison Bechtel in conversation with George McCallman. This program was recorded on May 7th, 2021. These broadcasts are produced by City Arts and Lectures in association with KQED Public Radio, San Francisco. Executive producers are Kate Goldstein-Breyer and Holly Mulder-Wallen. Director of Communications and Design is Alexandra Washkin. Juliet Gelfman-Rondazzo is Associate Director of Communications and Digital Media. The post-production director is Nina Thorson. The Sydney Goldstein Theater Director, Stephen Eckert. The recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Theme music composed and performed by Pat Gleason. The founding producer is Sydney Goldstein. City Arts and Lectures programs are supported by grants for the arts of the San Francisco Hotel Tax Fund. Additional funding provided by the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, the Mimi and Peter Haas Fund, the Bernard Osher Foundation, and the Friends of City Arts and Lectures. Support for recording and post-production of City Arts and Lectures is provided by Robert Mailer Anderson and Nicola Miner. To attend a live program, see who's coming next, or find out more about our podcast, Visit our website at cityarts.net. That's cityarts.net.
Special thanks to Anne Oyama for making our programs possible as we shelter in place at home.
These broadcasts are produced by City Arts and Lectures in association with KQED Public Radio, San Francisco. Executive producers are Kate Goldstein Breyer and Holly Mulder Wallen. Director of Communications and Design is Alexandra Washkin. Juliet Gelfman Rendazzo is Associate Director of Communications and Digital Media. The post-production director is Nina Thorson. Sydney Goldstein Theater Technical Director, Stephen Eckard. The recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Theme music is composed and performed by Pat Gleason. The founding producer is Sydney Goldstein. To attend a live program or for a list of upcoming events, visit our website at cityarts.net. That's cityarts.net.